Last Wednesday evening, as we continued our study through Paul's letter to the Colossians, we came to chapter 3, verse 16, which says, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." In our lesson, we focused on two aspects of this verse. The primacy of the word, let the word of Christ dwell among you richly, and the place of singing, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. In focusing on these, we took some time to think about the Bible and the singing of the early church. The Bible the Colossians would have used and the songs that they would have sung. And we looked at some of the songs of the early church that are quoted by the Apostle Paul in his epistles. I also said last week that I wanted to bring two and possibly three lessons from this verse. The one I brought last week, another one dealing with singing in the church more broadly, and then a third lesson that draws out some of the applications in this text for our individual Christian lives. Tonight we're going to have that second lesson. The title is fairly unimaginative, but it does tell you what our lesson is about. Singing in corporate worship. We know that singing in corporate worship has become a very controversial issue in evangelical circles over the last 30 or 40 years. There's even a term used to describe this controversy. Perhaps you've heard of the worship wars. And this controversy really is about musical style and the extent to which contemporary musical styles should be used in worship. Is it appropriate to take the music that we find in the top 40 on the radio, marry it with Christian lyrics, and bring that into the church? Is the kind of music that comes out of Hillsong and out of the mega churches in North America suitable for use in public worship? If the lyrics are okay, does musical style even matter? It's not my intention to dive into this controversy, although some of what I say tonight will certainly be applicable. Rather, my intention is to discern some of the guidelines or the parameters that the Apostle Paul gives us in this verse for our singing in corporate worship and for the kinds of songs that we should be singing. I have 8 points that I want to flesh out this evening from the text, but don't let that worry you. Most of them will be quite brief. Before I get to the first of these points, I want to reiterate something that I said last week, and that is God's people sing. They always have. I think I'm right in saying that the first example of singing in the Bible is in Exodus chapter 15. Now look, if you would please, at verses 1 and 2. "Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him." Now just drop down to verses 20 and 21. "And Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancers. And Miriam answered them, Sing ye to the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider hath he thrown into the sea." In response to God's deliverance of Israel through the Red Sea, Moses composed and sang a hymn of praise to the Lord. And then Miriam and the women took up the refrain. Now let's think about this for a moment. Before there was the temple, the priesthood, the musicians that led in corporate worship, before there was even the book of Psalms, there was singing. There was this impulse within Moses' heart and within the hearts of God's people to sing praises. And we can follow this through from Exodus to Revelation. What do we see at the end of the book? Well, we see God's people gathered around the throne in heaven singing a new song. Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, and hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. It seems to me that we were created to sing, and we've been redeemed to sing. And so what should we sing now? As we anticipate that great worship service in heaven, what should the singing in our worship services sound like today? Well, as I said, the Apostle Paul gives us some guidelines in our text here in Colossians chapter 3. And so let's get into them. Number one, purpose. Paul helps us understand the purpose of our singing. The command in this verse is in the opening line, let the word of Christ dwell in you. The only verb in the imperative mood is the word dwell. The other verbs are participles for you Greek grammar nerds, which don't have this same force. They don't have the force of a command. The dwelling of the word in or among the church at Colossae, that's the central concern in this text. The ways in which the word is to dwell in the church is through teaching and admonishing. And in this verse, Paul refers to singing as the means by which this teaching and admonishing takes place. Preaching is another way this happens, but here singing is the focus. And we talked about this last week, the horizontal aspect of singing in corporate worship. When we sing, we're doing something for each other, instructing each other and urging each other on in the Christian life. So the purpose, the goal in our singing when we come together is to make or to have the word of Christ dwell among us. And therefore, what we need and what we ought to have are songs that work towards that end. Songs that achieve this purpose. Songs that bring the word of Christ into our worship. Songs that fill our minds with the word of Christ. And that is the gospel, the doctrine of Christ, theology, the scriptures. If we're going to talk about parameters for singing in corporate worship, this is the widest possible boundary that we ought to set. At the very least, what we sing ought to bring the word of Christ into our worship. The lyrics and the musical style ought to have this goal clearly in view. So number one, Paul teaches us about the purpose of our singing in corporate worship. And then number two, he says something about character. And what I mean here is the character or the nature of the songs that we should sing. Notice that the word of Christ is to dwell richly in our midst. It's to be among us abundantly. It's to be immediately and obviously evident that the word of Christ is here. It lives in our midst as a local assembly of God's people. And what this means in terms of our singing is that we ought to sing distinctly Christian songs. That is, songs that are rich lyrically in the word of Christ. If you could take a worship song and switch Jesus' name for someone else's and the lyrics still make sense, then it seems to me that it's not a distinctly Christian song. It doesn't bring the word of Christ among us richly. The same applies if the song is anemic in terms of doctrine and theology. Even songs that talk about personal experience ought to be distinctly Christian and not of the Jesus is my boyfriend variety. They ought to be grounded in the word of Christ. They ought to bring to the fore who God is and what he has accomplished for us. And so we have here more guidance. The boundary of what's acceptable and what's not comes in a little further. Yes, the song in some sense brings the word of Christ into our worship, but does it do so richly? Is it a distinctly Christian song? Purpose, character, and then number three, Paul talks about function. That is the function of our singing in corporate worship, and we talked about this last week, teaching and admonishing one another. And all I want to say this evening is that we have to ask whether any given song performs this function. Or is it merely a vapid, mushy bowl of sentiment? Now, this is not to play off the intellect against the emotions, not at all. But even the most stirring songs ought to do this. They ought to teach us about God, teach us the Word, teach us how to live the Christian life, and exhort us to do so. The fourth point is accuracy. In our verse, we have this phrase, in all wisdom. And in our King James translation, the punctuation is such that it is made to apply to the first part of the verse. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. It's modifying Paul's command. In the original Greek, there was no punctuation. And furthermore, the grammar doesn't make it immediately clear where this little phrase applies. The sense could be, and probably is, more along these lines. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another. It's the teaching and admonishing that is to occur in all wisdom. Or we might say it's to occur wisely. And this is the way it ought to be. Not just in our singing, but in all the teaching and admonishing that takes place in the church. It's to be done in all wisdom. It's to be done skillfully, carefully, appropriately, by people who know what they're teaching and who know how to teach effectively. Part of that wisdom is to teach and admonish accurately, to communicate and bring to bear the word of Christ correctly. There shouldn't be confusion. And of course, there shouldn't be misrepresentation or error. And this applies to the teaching and admonishing in our singing. There ought to be theological accuracy. We need to sing truth and not error. I think it's fine to allow for a degree of poetic license in our songs. There is a place for imagery, for metaphors, for similes and other literary devices, but not at the expense of truth. The example that often comes to mind in this regard is in Charles Wesley's great hymn. We know what he meant, and we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, but it's not true. He left his father's throne above, so free, so infinite his grace, emptied himself of all but love, and bled for Adam's helpless race. Now we understand the point that Wesley is making, and it's a glorious point, but Jesus didn't empty himself of everything except love. All the fullness of the Godhead was in him. Following on from accuracy is what I've called clarity. And this is the fifth point for us to consider. And it's another aspect of wisdom. You know, a wise teacher is one who is clear. The songs we use in worship, the songs that are supposed to bring the word of Christ into our midst, ought to be clear. Now, maybe it's because I spend a lot of time thinking about theology, or because I'm a bit of a word nerd, but I am particularly sensitized to this. It's a bit of a hobby horse. In our doctrine of Christ, for example, there are some fine distinctions that we make, but they're incredibly important. The words that we use matter a great deal. Words that have been hammered out over centuries of study and debate. We acknowledge the same Son, Christ, Lord, only begotten in two natures, inconfusedly, unchangeably, indivisibly, inseparably. Those four famous words in the definition of Chalcedon, very precise words, are essential to the way we understand the person of Christ. They keep us from deadly error. They keep us from polluting the gospel. Now, I'm not saying that the songs we sing in worship need to get down to that fine level of detail. But they ought not to be vague or ambiguous or confusing. Vague platitudes about God that could be taken one way or another are not appropriate in worship. They fail to teach and admonish wisely. If the lyrical content leaves you scratching your head, then the song fails. It shouldn't be sung. There is a song that's being used in worship today, and the music video on YouTube has over 770,000 views. And this is the chorus. Light up the way of your heart. Move me like you do the mountains. Move me like you do the wind. And I'll chase your voice through the dark. Fix my eyes on the unexpected. In the wonder of your shadow, step. Take another step. I think I get some of what that means, but fix my eyes on the unexpected. I don't get that. I mean, if God fixes my eyes on the unexpected, then won't it be expected? I mean, that makes no sense. That's nonsense. It spectacularly fails the clarity test. Hey, it doesn't teach and admonish in all wisdom. The sixth point concerning our singing in the text here is type. The type of songs we as God's people are to sing when we come together. And we talked about these last week. I defined what each of these terms mean, so I'm not going to expand upon them tonight. Paul mentions psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And these are to be sung, the text says, with grace in our heart. And that's point number seven. Purpose, character, function, accuracy, clarity, type. And now, attitude. Most of the time the Greek word translated grace in this verse appears in the New Testament, it's translated just this way, with our English word grace. Occasionally it's translated thank or thanks. And that's probably the idea here. The reference might be to singing with God's grace in our hearts, that is, singing full of the experience of God's kindness, but it's more likely that Paul is referring to gratitude. We're to sing with thankfulness in our hearts. That makes a bit more sense. And there are other English versions that translate it this way. The bigger point here is that what's happening in our hearts when we sing in corporate worship is important. In commenting on this verse, Dr. MacArthur writes, Paul's concern here is that the heart agree with the mouth. True worship, Jesus told us in John 4, is in spirit and in truth. It involves our spirit, our inner man. Saying or singing certain words has never been enough. Mere outward observance has always fallen short. We might have songs that meet all of the criteria that I've just laid out. They're rich in the word of Christ, distinctly Christian, accurate, clear, and we can sing them in our church services and yet fail to worship. The song can fail to do in us what it's supposed to do, to teach and admonish, because our heart is not engaged. There is no grace in the heart. Our mind must be involved and our heart must be right. Wonderful words must be sung sincerely. And it's good for us from time to time to think about our singing on the Lord's Day. Now, do we just go through the motions? Here we go again. The music's playing. We stand up, we sing, we sit down. Does our mind tend to wander while we're singing? Do we concentrate on what we're singing and what the words mean? Do we realise the seriousness of what we're saying and of what we're doing in those moments in our worship service? Do we ever think about the condition of our heart before we open our mouth in praise to the Lord? The last thing we learn about our singing in corporate worship from this verse has to do with what I've called direction. The direction of our singing. Singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. The focus in this verse is the horizontal aspect of our singing. We teach and admonish one another when we sing. But we have to recognise that ultimately in public worship our singing is to the Lord. The vertical aspect is preeminent. Again, to quote Dr. MacArthur, singing is to be directed to God as praise and worship offered for his pleasure and glory. That it is edifying to believers is a byproduct of its main purpose. Our singing is, in the words of the writer to the Hebrews, the sacrifice of praise to God, the fruit of our lips giving thanks to his name. And in my view, this is where all of the issues surrounding musical style come to the fore. This is the crux of the matter. We make decisions about this in light of who it is we're singing to, who it is we're aiming to please. As I said in the introduction, I don't really want to get into the worship wars this evening. Perhaps we can talk some more afterwards about questions of musical style and contemporary worship. But I do want to say one thing. I want to do so by way of an illustration. Part of the pleasure of watching a film is the way that music is used. I mean, it's an immensely powerful tool in the hands of the movie maker. Imagine watching a two-hour film with no music. It would be a very different experience. Imagine Star Wars without the music. We know that music can be deployed to enhance the emotional power of a scene, to create tension, to invoke pity for the characters. And we also know that music can be used in an ironic or counterintuitive way. It can be used to send a mixed message. There is a happy scene with sad music. There's some different message that the director wants to send. Or perhaps it's a sad scene with happy music. We've probably all experienced this. The pictures, the scene is saying one thing, but the music is saying something else. There is this dissonance, and it's often deliberate. Music has this power. It can support and carry along a particular message, intensify it, or it can confuse that message or even send a different one. I can't explain this power. I don't know how and why music has a direct line to the emotional part of us, but we all know it does. And so, if our singing in corporate worship is to do all these things that I've spelled out this evening, and if ultimately it's directed to the Lord, then the music matters. Musical style matters. The music can support and carry along the message of the words, or it can confuse that message or even send a different one. It's a complex issue, but at the very least we have to recognise that it's not just the words that are important in deciding what's appropriate for worship. It's the music as well. And so, there you have it. 8 points from Colossians chapter 3 verse 16 that set the parameters for our singing. Guidelines to help us in our worship today as we look forward to that great worship service in heaven. Amen.